This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Perseverance. It's a word talked about often in sports. Usually it refers to an athlete who pushed through a particularly tough game or maybe through a months-long recovery from injury. But not many professional athletes have persevered as long or through as much as Rich Hill. WBUR's Shira Springer has our story.
Who I am. My name is Rich Hill. I grew up in Milton, Mass. I'm married with my wife, Caitlin, our sons, Bryce and Brooks.
This is how Rich Hill begins to introduce himself.
We're currently right now with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So I guess that's my job title, pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
For much of his career, however, Hill had precious little job security. And a year ago, it didn't seem like he'd find any.
There's a couple points in our career. I say our career because my wife has been there through every step of the way, and it's been an incredible journey. And when we talk about perseverance, it's really just, you know, not trying to be perfect as we're going through this life. Because, you know, when we look back on the journey, it's a mess.
Over 12 years, Hill has played for 8 different major league teams, moving from Chicago to Baltimore to Boston to Cleveland to Anaheim to New York to Oakland to L.A. And there have been many minor league stops in between. When his major league career began with the Cubs in 2005, he was a promising young starter with a wicked curveball. But soon, control issues and injuries set in. Shoulder surgery in 2009 dramatically altered his future.
You think when you go in for surgery, you come out, okay, I'm fixed. Well, that wasn't really the case. So that's what led to me dropping down and actually throwing sidearm, you know, for those 5 years out of the bullpen.
Hill went from prize starter to journeyman reliever. But the hardest part came with the birth of his son, Brooks, in 2013.
Yeah, so a little tough to talk about, but it was an amazing day. Going in on Christmas night to the hospital, we were both excited. We had left our son at home with actually my brother, so he was very excited about seeing his new brother. When he was born, we knew that something may not be right.
Brooks was born on December 26th. At first glance, he looked normal, but his arms and legs stayed unnaturally contracted, hinting at major health issues.
And as the days and the weeks unfolded, we found out that, he had lissencephaly, which is a smoothness of the brain, and polymicrogyri in the back of his brain, where his neurons didn't completely form to where they should have connected in his brain, and also congenital nephrotic syndrome, where his kidneys were failing when he was born, right, from day one. So that was when we found that out, that was extremely difficult.
Doctors said Brooks needed a kidney transplant, and Hill talked with his wife about what their son's quality of life would be.
He was in so much pain every single day, and with the underlying issues of lissencephaly and the polymicrogyri, knowing that he is going to have an extremely difficult path for, 2 to 5 years of the rest of his life if this kidney transplant was successful. Who are we doing this for? Are we doing it for ourselves to hold on to somebody, or are we doing it really in his best interest? When I look back on it, there's no right answer. But for us, we decided to take him home on hospice, and he ended up spending the last 3 days of his life, at our house with us, and it was great.
Rich and his wife tried to help their son Bryce understand what was happening to his baby brother.
It wasn't easy because you're telling, a little kid at 2 years old that, his brother isn't going to be here. He was in the hospital with us, with everything. He all the way through to the end, and he was amazing.
Brooks passed away when he was barely 2 months old. 10 days later, Hill reported to spring training with the Boston Red Sox.
The Boston Red Sox organization was amazing, saying, hey, look, take your time. But, I think my wife and I, we... Life keeps moving forward. It doesn't matter. People die. Daily life continues. But with, a different view on life and understanding of time and how precious life is, we live for our son Brooks and with his memory on an everyday basis.
Hill began the 2014 season with Boston's AAA affiliate, Pawtucket. In July, he was traded to Anaheim. Less than 2 weeks later, Hill was released. Unsure of what the future held, he returned home to Boston.
And I just found a brick wall, and I'd throw off the brick wall, and then I'd go over to BC High in the parking lot, and they have a off the side of their gym, and I'd just, you know, throw the ball off the wall there and play long toss. Anyway, 2 days goes by, and the Yankees call me back and say, hey, you know, come on back to New York. And, you know, I don't know. So 2 days later, I'm back in the big leagues, you know, facing David Ortiz with, you know, runners on second and third, and, you know, after playing catch off the wall the day before. You know, it's crazy when you look back. Those are things, those are little things that happened along the way.
Still, when the 2015 season started, Hill found himself with the Syracuse Chiefs, the AAA affiliate of the Washington Nationals, and he decided to opt out of his contract. He thought he might find a spot in the majors with another organization. He didn't. He was no longer a prized young starter. He was a 35-year-old reliever with two major surgeries and multiple minor league stints on his resume. Hill knew he was a risky investment, so he made a risky move, deciding to play for an independent league team. Because independent league teams don't have any affiliation with Major League Baseball, they're often a last resort for pro players. And as long as Hill was making that move, he wanted to make one more.
I said, if I'm going to go to independent ball and pitch, I want to get back into starting because this is my opportunity right now. You know, I felt healthy enough to be able to take that opportunity in Long Island.
And so he entered the colorful world of independent league baseball.
Walking down through the tunnel to get to the dugout, you know, I looked over, I saw a bucket. Well, there's your bathroom. So.
Meanwhile, on the mound, Hill embraced the opportunity the Long Island Ducks offered.
I felt good. I felt strong. I felt healthy. My shoulder felt great for the first time throwing over the top in 6 years. I remember talking to Marty, the pitching coach, one day, and he said, what are you doing here? Because, you know, the ball was coming out great out of my hand. And I said, well, I would look at it the same way if I was in the front office. You know, I can't just release a guy to let some guy start for us that hasn't started in 6 years. You know, we have to see something.
Hill made his Ducks debut on August 2nd, 2015, pitching against the Bridgeport Bluefish. The left-hander threw 5 innings of no-hit baseball. In his second start, he struck out 14 batters in 6 innings, tying a franchise record.
I knew that the way the ball was coming out of my hand, the way the spin for my breaking ball was, you know, presenting itself out of my hand, I knew there was going to be an opportunity to get to the big leagues.
Hill was back in the major leagues by mid-September.
His first start since 2009 for Boston native Rich Hill. As that is in there for strike three.
In 4 starts for the Red Sox, he went 2-1 with a 1.55 ERA and 36 strikeouts. The Red Sox wanted to bring Hill back, but the Oakland Athletics offered him more certainty of starting. Hill signed with the Athletics during the offseason, then landed with the LA Dodgers after an August 2016 trade.
Pitcher number 44, Rich Hill.
During the Dodgers' playoff run, Hill earned a win over his first team, the Cubs. And barely 6 weeks later, the Dodgers showed how much they valued the veteran. Hill earned the first long-term, big-money contract of his career. And at the press conference announcing the deal, both his sons came to mind.
I'd like to thank my family who is here today, my wife, Caitlin. Excuse me. Our sons, Bryce and Brooks. You know, this is a great day for us.
But it was about more than his new 3-year, $48 million contract.
I think about our son, you know, and it's always something that for me is, it's extremely emotional. We made the decision to live for Brooks. So, you know, and with our son Bryce and keeping Brooks's memory alive, you know, not only for us and for everyone else, but also for him. So he understands that, you know, he had a brother. He had a brother, and he has a brother. I mean, he'll always bring up baby Brooks, and he'll mention, you know, he knows that he's in heaven, and You know, if he finds a feather, he always thinks, you know, he says Baby Brooks is leaving him little messages and stuff like that. So he may not be with us physically, but, you know, we believe that he's with us every single day.
For Only a Game, I'm Shira Springer.
Another year has slipped into the void where past years go. It's nearly time for football to put on its greatest show. It's celebrated coast to coast, from sea to shining sea, by people who love football. Sure, for they are bound to be enthralled by that great contest between the two teams that remain. When waves of football drama have washed down the football drain, the hopeless and the hopeful, the dynamic, the inert, the scramblers and the gamblers, and the healthy and the hurt, the highly touted candidates, the underdogs who tried against the odds to beat the best and beaten, finally sighed and left the stage to just the two teams destined then to roll onto that biggest, brightest stage of all, the Super Bowl. But super hardly covers it. It's super, super. No, it's big beyond enormous. Even though one cannot go unless one has more money than a fool should ever spend to watch a game between two teams while sitting in the end zone. You see, it transcends a meter as it dwarfs the world at large. It brings to this bleak time of year a monumental charge. I know the game itself is still some playoff tilts away, but they're part of the build-up to that most exciting day, without anticipation. For the game that caps the season, what desperate soul could now discover any valid reason for wading through the snow and sleet and hail that's sometimes raining upon us in this gulf that stands between us and spring training? We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first I'd like to thank Bellers N, who left this review of our podcast. Sports news the way it ought to be. Fun, and they devote time to the offbeat, putting the mainstream overhyped sports on the back burner. Refreshing. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's time for the NFL playoffs. Fans will now get to watch the league's very best compete, right? Right? That's where we're going to begin this week's three stories you should know. My guests this time around are Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and Karen Given, who has the desk right next to mine. Greetings and salutations to both of you.
Hey, Bill.
Hello.
Mike, I'm sure football is on your mind. What's up?
So the NFL is at bottom an entertainment enterprise. No, I know they couch themselves in the language of grit and America and adversity, but it's supposed to be entertaining. That's
yes.
why they make
yeah.
money. I cannot see how one would define the game between the Raiders and the Texans as entertaining. Here are the quarterbacks of this NFL enterprise. A guy named Connor Cook, starting in his first ever NFL game for the Raiders. They had a very good quarterback. Derek Carr went down. Then Matt McGloin, funny named Matt McGloin, also went down in week 17. So enter Connor Cook, first time ever that a guy is making his debut in an NFL playoff game. The Texans have a winning record. They are a terrible, terrible team. An outfit called Football Outsiders does a pretty good statistical analysis. It's at least consistent from year to year. And Houston is worse than San Francisco, which finished the season 2-14. The guy who they at least wanted to be quarterback, he went down with a concussion. There is Brock Osweiler, who had 15 touchdowns, 16 interceptions, and was the worst free agent signing of this year.
I am so glad that you mentioned the quarterback situation, because it gives me the opening to talk about my favorite fake news story of the week. And I know we're all supposed to hate fake news, but listen to this. Breaking: Texans Raiders agree to hire Peyton Manning as all-time quarterback for their wild card game. So this is from the Sports Pickle. And they basically just set up a world in which both teams decide our quarterbacks are so bad, let's just bring back Peyton and have him play for both sides. Now that would be entertaining.
Archie's an improvement. Forget Peyton.
All right, you guys are not going to believe this, but I'm going to stand up for football. First of all, the NFL has a system that it works as well as a system can work in terms of determining which team should be in the playoffs, right? I don't know how you would tweak that particular system to make it produce more appealing playoff games. Secondly, two bad teams can certainly produce an entertaining game. They might set a record for fumbles. They might set a record for number of times the kicker hits the crossbar. Mm-hmm. Any number of fascinating circumstances could happen.
This is what the NFL wants, parity. Any team could win, and yet we have to watch any team play. It's the sort of game that had me asking, is Storks out on DVD yet?
Karen, I understand you have been focused on the act of tripping, which doesn't sound particularly promising to me and makes me a little concerned for my safety in the space between our two desks.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
Watch out, Bill. Yeah, so on Wednesday, Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski lifted the, quote, indefinite suspension of Duke guard Grayson Allen. Allen had been suspended for tripping an opponent and having a meltdown on the bench afterwards. It wasn't his first time tripping an opponent. It wasn't his second. It was his third tripping offense. But he only served one game suspension. That indefinite suspension became one game, and it was a loss to Virginia Tech on New Year's Eve, and people are kind of losing their minds. But then also, there are a lot of explanations, aka justifications, as to why Duke was right to do this. One is that Coach K was going out for back surgery, and he wanted the team all set before he left, so he released the suspension, which kind of leaves the message that it's wrong to trip an opponent unless your coach is going out for back surgery, and then it's just fine. But there's one argument that really sort of works for me, and it's this. The ACC, the conference that Duke plays in, decided not to do anything. Don't suspend him. Don't punish him in any way. The NCAA decided not to do anything. Don't suspend him. Don't punish him in any way. So if those two organizations don't want to step up and do something, why do we expect Duke to step up and do something? I mean, isn't Duke in the business of winning basketball games?
Well, isn't Mike Krzyzewski in charge of both those organizations? It seems to me, having watched basketball, he is. So they would defer to him, much bigger than the sub-poobas at the NCAA.
I think if a booster had offered this kid a hamburger to trip somebody, he'd have been out for the rest of the season because the NCAA would have been all over it.
Yes, gifts in kind. But, you know, Duke needs an arch-villain, usually a white arch-villain, to win a championship. Mm-hmm. You know, Leitner and Hurley and J.J. Redick. Like, this is the archetype of Duke. And so Grayson Allen comes along, and he looks a lot like Ted Cruz. So he has this arch-villain vibe, but he doesn't really act archly villainous until he starts tripping people. So I think this really argues well for Duke's going deep into the tournament.
To be serious about this for just a minute, it seems to me that the one-game suspension simply suggests that as far as men's basketball goes, Duke is no different from any other competitive D1 program. Fringe players who do stupid or illegal things get cut, and everybody talks about how the coach has things in perspective. More significant players do stupid or illegal things, and the coach says they need the discipline that basketball or football can provide, and that will help them mature as fine young men. We probably ought to stop talking about particular programs as somehow always doing it right, because I don't think any of them do.
It is about winning games no matter where you're playing and who you're playing for. And I'm really, I started off thinking grr, Duke on this one, and I sort of brought myself around. I've given up on the idea that Duke should be punishing this kid. However, like the meltdown on the bench afterwards, the fact that he can't seem to stop tripping people.
And blatantly doing
blatantly,
it. It's
just that
these are not subtle trips.
People.
These are, I'm going to stick my leg out and you're going over it.
So I've given up on the idea that Duke should punish him, but I do kind of wonder if he has a little self-control problem, maybe a problem with anger, and maybe he should be being helped with that.
All right, enough with football and basketball. This week, Ashton Eaton retired, and I wonder how many people hearing me say that are asking themselves who. But the fact is that now somebody else is going to have to become the world's greatest athlete because Ashton Eaton won the decathlon at each of the past two Olympics. The guy who won the decathlon used to be regarded as the world's greatest athlete. Think Bruce Jenner, if you like. Among this nation's enthusiastic football, basketball, baseball, hockey, soccer, and tennis fans, who regards a guy who runs three races, throws a javelin and a discus, jumps over hurdles and so on as the world's greatest athlete? It's just not happening anymore. And that isn't Ashton Eaton's fault. And maybe more attention should be paid than has been paid. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I love the decathlon. I love somewhat obscure Olympic sports. The question is, why is it obscure? First of all, I think the scoring system really is an impediment to getting into the decathlon. It relies on decimals and numbers that you can't crunch. And the other thing is, I know that's the branding of world's greatest athlete, but I don't think most people believe it because if you're such a great athlete, the argument would go, wouldn't you maybe be a Deion Sanders or Bo Jackson in two sports that are well-loved? By dominating these obscure sports, you're great at the decathlon, and that's a certain skill set. But is it ipso facto that you are the greatest athlete? I don't know the answer to that. The decathlon's, you know, it has a lot of power. It has a lot of endurance. It is a pretty broad range of athleticism. I just don't know that it attracts the best athlete. That said, what this guy has done, you're absolutely right. As an American who's so dominant in this discipline, should absolutely be celebrated more.
One of the things that I think is super interesting is that the website 538 did this statistical analysis of what fans think are the best and worst Olympic sports. And the decathlon's right up there. I mean, it's ranked number 8, you know, behind things like track and field 100 meter, the 4x100 meter relay.
The component parts of the decathlon, in other words.
Right. Exactly. So people seem to intellectually understand that it's a great sport, yet people don't seem to want to watch it. And I have a theory on that. And that's this. Sports is about entertainment. It's not about what's hardest. It's not about what's best. It's not about what's most important. And we could say that about everything. We don't read Moby Dick very often, but a whole lot of people read 50 Shades of Grey. That doesn't mean 50 Shades of Grey is better than Moby Dick.
You don't read Moby Dick very often?
No, never, never.
That dog-eared copy of Moby Dick on your desk is just a prop?
Yes, it is a paperweight.
I would have, but my safe word is Ishmael, and so I stopped at word three.
Anyway, so yeah, this is
and
my point.
Herman Melville takes it on the chin once again.
Yep.
Number one, let's see Deion Sanders try and throw the discus. Number two, there's a story about this guy that I just encountered that I really love. Apparently, when he was a little kid, he read this fantasy piece that said, if there were ever an intergalactic competition and every planet had the opportunity to send just one athlete out to be its champion and represent the planet, the Earth should send their top decathlete. And finally, in order to utterly subvert and sink my own position, the world's greatest athlete was Willie Mays. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So my guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and Karen Given, who typically writes sentences like the one you're hearing right now so that I can say them. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
You're welcome.
In a spare room, Vinay Krishnan watched last year's NBA playoffs. There was a TV in one corner. There were chairs pushed against the walls. Except for Krishnan and four or five of his friends, those chairs were empty.
The staff members would kind of leave us alone. They'd pop in every now and then just to see the score. And we'd just watch. And I don't know, it's the most normal thing we did while we were there, right? Because we were just sitting around watching sports. So we didn't really feel like we were in a hospital or anything. You know, for those couple of hours, we felt like just like any other people.
Krishnan and his friends weren't any other people. They were voluntary patients in a facility, Krishnan calls it the center, specializing in treating people with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Well, it was pretty overwhelming at first just to leave your home and go to this place, be surrounded by people you don't know, and just the structure of it where, you know, all the bathrooms are locked. You have to ask permission to get into a bathroom. There's 24-hour staff around you at all times, cooking your meals and stuff. You can't drink, which took a lot of getting used to. And you can't even, like, touch another patient, so there's just really strange, like, boundaries.
During his 9 weeks at the center, Krishnan watched each of the Cleveland Cavaliers playoff games, and it wasn't only because they made his evening feel more normal. Krishnan saw a link between his OCD treatment and the efforts of LeBron James, who was trying to bring Cleveland its first championship in 52 years. Krishnan became aware of his OCD in September of 2001, when the World Trade Center buildings were destroyed. He was 13 years old.
It was just kind of sparked by this idea that that kind of thing could happen to all those people, then anything horrible could happen to any of us. So that kind of sparked my OCD mind to just start imagining all these horrible things that could happen. And then my compulsions would be to try to prevent those things from happening. So one example would be every night before I went to sleep, I would have to lock the front door, which we all do. That's a completely rational thing to do. But it's not rational if you're staring at it for an hour and just locking it and unlocking it and doing it over and over again. And over time, those hours add up and it can start to really debilitate your life, and you're just constantly in that trap of being anxious. But I didn't really know what I was dealing with. I just thought I had these peculiar behaviors and I didn't seem to see anyone else doing this kind of stuff. And you're just confused and you're kind of filled with a certain degree of shame because it seems like you're stranger than everybody. So I didn't actually get treatment for it until I was 24.
Krishnan is now 28. He's an attorney. He had some free time between projects last spring, and that gave him an opportunity for some especially intensive work related to his condition. That's why he was at the center. There he met daily with psychiatrists, behavioral therapists, and family therapists. He and the other patients also underwent 4 hours of daily exposure therapy. Krishnan's exposure therapy involved videos of terrorist attacks and mass shootings. Part of the idea was desensitization. He was learning to watch those videos without becoming consumed by his compulsions.
That's just, you know, terrifying at first. At the end of the 4 hours, you just spent...
Which was part of the reason that at the end of the day, watching basketball was a relief. It was a bonus that Krishnan could see his favorite player, LeBron James.
The reason I was really drawn to him, more than any of the dunks or the physical stuff, was just that he was devoted to making the right play at the right time. And in this post-Jordan world, every star that came up was kind of expected to take the last shot, even if there were two guys draped over him. Iverson did it, Vince Carter did it, Tracy McGrady did it, Kobe definitely did it. And LeBron was kind of the first guy that said, well, no, it makes more sense if my shooter's open in the corner, I'm going to pass it to him.
Krishnan had been a James fan for a long time. During those playoffs, he found himself thinking about a 2013 interview that James had given to ESPN. James had said he was afraid of failure, that he wanted to succeed so badly that he'd become anxious that he wouldn't. Vinay Krishnan could relate.
So for him to admit that and say that's what I'm chasing and still say I do fear failure, I think it's just kind of impressive that he would put himself out there like that. When I read that, I thought that was huge. I was really surprised more people don't talk about it. And so that interview has always been in the back of my head.
Krishnan began noticing what LeBron James was doing to manage his anxiety about failure.
Before the playoffs, he would take himself off social media. And he would start actually meditating on the sidelines. And he would read books before playoff games. And, I mean, I guess any one of those actions doesn't seem particularly significant. But if you put them all together, that's a clear effort to be more mindful and embrace the present moment rather than worrying about what happened last night, worrying about what's going to happen in a couple hours after tip-off. He's just taking himself out of those moments and focusing on what's in front of him. And that's a very common skill that anyone who's been in treatment for anxiety or OCD, we've all done stuff like that. We all practice mindfulness.
His intensive treatment completed, Krishnan watched the Cavaliers beat the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals from home. And he saw in Cleveland's comeback from a 3-1 deficit further evidence that James' strategies were working.
It was clear to me that he'd grown as a player, and it wasn't just a physical growth. There was something else to that, and I thought that was really instructive for the rest of us.
For the time being, Vinay Krishnan is concentrating on his writing rather than on the practice of law. His recent essay for Slam magazine is titled, What I Learned Watching LeBron James During My OCD Treatment. He has no illusions about an instant cure for himself or anyone else, but he says the center taught him skills to better manage his disorder. Krishnan, who himself went 11 years before receiving treatment, has seen others also wait far too long.
And that kind of thing doesn't really change unless people start telling their stories in public. and getting their narratives out there and combating stigma. And so when I wrote this article, I wanted to make some small, tiny contribution to that effort.
Since Christian made his story public, he's heard from lots of people, some of them basketball fans, who are dealing with OCD. And he's only a little disappointed that he hasn't heard from the fellow who inspired him to write the article.
I would love to hear from LeBron on this. That's the one I'm still waiting for. I think if he read it, he would like it.
Vinay Krishnan's probably right about that. Who wouldn't enjoy being singled out as a guy who'd help somebody just by being who he was, doing what he did, and talking about it? We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports, NPR style. Ahead in only a game, William Red Hill Sr. saved 28 people from drowning, but he could not save all the members of his family from the dangerous allure of the Niagara.
People still wonder and ask questions about why Red Hill Jr. went over the falls. After researching it for 40 years, I can't put one answer to it.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, former Major League umpire Steve Palermo tells the story of how he returned to baseball after being told he'd never walk again. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Monday night, college football will crown its champion, and in preparation for that game, Alabama head coach Nick Saban fired the guy who's been running the team's offense. So I guess, does that give Alabama the advantage over Clemson?
To be perfectly fair to Coach Saban, Lane Kiffin, the offensive coordinator he fired, is a man born to be fired.
Has been fired before.
And has been fired for an incredible number of different reasons. Was once left at the airport after being fired. But my favorite thing about this is that upon putting out the statement, which Coach Saban thought would settle the whole matter, he was asked about it. And finally, he said, "There is no why, there is no if, there is no but. It just is what it is. The statement says what it is. We're moving forward, so let's talk about the game." That's somewhere between Bill Belichick and Yoda, I think.
The Chicago Bears ended the 2016 season with a record of 3-13, so they are not among the teams competing in the NFL's postseason. Alshon Jeffrey, a wide receiver for the Bears, does not seem to be discouraged by this.
No, this is a great story because Alshon Jeffrey said, quote, "I guarantee you we'll win the Super Bowl next year." This is right on the heels of finishing the 3-13 season. His teammates rallied behind him, saying they liked the boldness of his prediction. But guess what? Alshon Jeffrey is a free agent, and he might not be playing in Chicago.
We may
next
win
year.
The Super Bowl somewhere
else. We may
else.
Win the Super Bowl. May well mean the Pittsburgh Steelers.
There was a simmering controversy, or maybe a baking, broiling, or frying controversy, leading up to this weekend's Pittsburgh-Miami playoff game. The Permonte Brothers restaurant chain declined to serve fish. So that ought to show the Dolphins, right?
Dolphins are not fish. They're mammals.
Well, perhaps.
Shut up, Donnie. You're out of your element.
Perhaps they won't serve mammals either.
Well, I mean, perhaps they won't serve mammals. Perhaps perhaps the whatever team is playing the Giants will serve nothing but short people.
Nothing but short people. This is, yeah. The now, I mean, Steelers will
people,
definitely
people
not serve people who've broken the law.
Yeah, exactly. If they're, you know, whoever's playing the Packers, the restaurants will not serve anybody who works on, say, an automotive assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's limitless.
The women's basketball team at UConn has won 89 games in a row. If they win on Tuesday, they will break the NCAA record, which, of course, they currently hold. Back at the beginning of the college basketball season, you and I expressed astonishment that UConn was not the top-rated women's team. I guess it's a good thing we expressed that astonishment when we could.
Yeah, I still don't understand that ball. I mean, apparently UConn is never going to lose a basketball game. The women's team is never going to lose a basketball game ever.
Milt Schmidt had been the oldest living former NHL player. He died this week. He was 98. His career was no doubt over before you were born, but have you a Milt Schmidt story to tell us?
Well, he was the general manager of the Bruins for a long time and, you know, helped put together the Bobby Orr, Phil Esposito teams in the 70s. He was always around. My favorite Milt Schmidt story is when he signed up for the Royal Canadian Air Force during World War II. This gives you an idea of how old Milt Schmidt was. He was playing for the Bruins at the beginning of World War II. And after a game, the Canadiens, whom they were playing, the arch rivals of the Bruins forever, carried him and a couple of his teammates who had enlisted off the ice on their shoulders.
Serena Williams is getting married. Not surprising, I suppose, but her ring is a little bit unusual.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now, Bill, and it doesn't make any... It looks like something you might get with your Happy Meal. But apparently it's very expensive, and it has a corn tortilla on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you want to break the power of the diamond cartels, you know, start putting snack food on expensive engagement rings.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's the ring she'll actually be wearing.
It's a great-looking ring, though.
When she goes to the altar,
I'm telling you right now.
I think she was having some fun with people who wanted to see the ring.
I hope not, Bill, because this is really classic. And I'm looking forward to somebody who gets engaged with, like, a leg of KFC on their hand or something.
Big hamburger or whatever, yeah. All right, I've been looking forward to sharing this sentence fragment with you all week. You ready?
Yeah.
The final of the World Darts Championship was marred by...
Someone stole the trophy! Well, it actually didn't steal it. Just ran out and grabbed it.
I've got it now!
It's head. Usually, in my limited experience, darts competitions are generally interrupted only by the bartender saying, "Last call!"
or by one of the competitors falling face down into the spaghetti. Exactly.
Please tell me that the participants threw darts at this guy
when he grabbed the trophy. I really hope
that's gone unsaid in the story. And
it's got to be an updated story that tells us that he was suddenly peppered with darts. Finally, Charlie, any coach found guilty of using witchcraft in an African soccer match will face a 4-game ban and a fine. I can't wait until FIFA looks into this new rule.
Well, first of all, I don't think there are any practitioners of witchcraft who can afford the bribes to let FIFA look the other way. So I think FIFA will probably be on top of this. Actually, this has become a thing. There was a football match in Rwanda, and one of the strikers ran over to the goalpost and put down a, quote, unidentified object, which got him a yellow card.
But witchery clearly was involved.
And remarkably, the referee who gave him the yellow card immediately disappeared.
Yeah.
No, that's not true.
But more remarkably, the guy who put the unidentified object by the goal immediately scored.
He did.
And there's
the
worked.
Why would you put it on the post, though? Why wouldn't you just toss it into the goal?
Well,
you could hit the post.
Would have been too obvious.
Or did the post move?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, and, of course, he joins me each week here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Michael Clarkson grew up along the banks of the Niagara River. As a young reporter, he collected stories of people who challenged the river's dangerous 165-foot falls, including the first three to do so.
Annie Edson Taylor went over the falls in a wooden whiskey barrel in 1901. Annie was a bored 63-year-old teacher. She went over the falls, had some bumps and bruises, and she did it. In 1911, Bobby Leach, a stuntman from England, went over in a glorified septic tank. He went on a vaudeville tour, and unfortunately for him, when he was on tour in New Zealand, he slipped on an orange peel and died of gangrene in his leg. In 1920, a barber from Bristol, England, Charles Stevens, went over in a Russian oak barrel. Unfortunately for him, he tied an anvil to his leg, and in the descent, the anvil pulled him through the barrel, and they only found body parts of him later on.
Clarkson also heard of a heroic river man and his family whose tales are interwoven with a history of daredevilry and rescue at the falls. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
William Red Hill Sr. was born on October 27, 1887, in Niagara Falls, Ontario. His career saving lives began when he carried his 4-year-old sister, Cora, out of their family's burning home. For his bravery, he was awarded a medal from the Royal Canadian Humane Society. He was just 9 years old. But the perilous waters of the Niagara River, not fire, was where he saved the most lives. Hill became a powerful swimmer. As a young man, he swam the Niagara's lower rapids from the American to the Canadian side in a record time of 11 minutes. In 1911, it was Hill who rescued Bobby Leach from his glorified septic tank. The following year, Hill made international headlines.
In 1912, it was allowed for tourists to go below the falls on these big formed ice bridges. In fact, Red Hill Sr. had a whiskey hut. He would sell whiskey and other liquor on the ice bridge right below the falls. But one day, ice cracked and the floes parted and the tourists were separated and screaming and running for help. Red Hill Sr. was able to get 23 of them off to shore. Unfortunately, a man and his wife were trapped and died in an ice floe which went down the rapids and into the whirlpool.
Hill fought in France during World War I with the Canadian Army's 4th Division, which helped the Allies capture Vimy Ridge from the Germans. He suffered poison gas inhalation, tuberculosis, and a gunshot wound during his tour of duty. He was given 6 months to live by a doctor and was sent home to die. But a couple days later...
I think one of the incredible rescues of all time in North America was when Red Hill plucked two men off a scow above Niagara Falls in 1918.
A small dredging scow with two men aboard broke free of its tugboat and grounded on rocks 1,500 yards above the falls.
When he got there, soldiers from both sides of the border, firemen, police were there, but nobody knew what to do because the scow was about 1,200 feet offshore. And the only man who had the expertise was Red Hill. So he went out and crawled along these lines which were shot out to the scow from a building on shore. It took him many hours, but he was able to scramble and rescue these two men, these two sailors, off the scow one at a time and received a life-saving medal for that.
But as Red Hill Sr. made headlines for his daring rescues, the river brought out the daredevil in him. In 1920, Hill jumped in Bobby Leach's barrel, yes, the same glorified septic tank, and rode it about 10 miles through the perilous Lower Rapids to Queenstown, Ontario. He repeated that journey in 1930, and again in 1931, before about 25,000 spectators.
He got trapped in the whirlpool, and his teenage son, Red Hill Jr., became the newest hero, and he swam out with a rope around his waist and saved his father from the whirlpool. After that, Red Sr. Did not try any more daredevil feats. Red Hill Sr. died in 1942 of natural causes. He was only 54 years old, but his wife Beatrice thought the river in World War I wore his body down.
During his lifetime, Red Hill Sr. recovered the bodies of 177 people who died from accident or suicide. He's officially credited with saving the lives of 28 people from drowning. He received more life-saving awards from the Canadian government than any person in history.
Red Hill Sr., I think he was a true hero. The Red Hill family, I think, was the first family of Niagara Falls.
Red Hill Sr. had planned several times to go over the falls, but he never attempted it. He called it a fool's game. His sons Corky and Wesley limited themselves to rescue and recovery missions. Another son, Major Hill, tried going over once but ran aground before he reached the falls. And 9 years after his father's death, Red Hill Jr. started planning.
People still wonder and ask questions about why Red Hill Jr. went over the falls. After researching it for 40 years, I can't put one answer to it. In Red Hill Jr.'s case, his life was a bit of a mess at the time in 1951. He'd just become separated from his wife and daughter. His father had died 9 years prior to that. He really missed him. He had been charged as a game warden with misappropriating funds and spent a little time in jail. The family's reputation was sullied a little bit. I think Junior wanted to bring that back.
But Clarkson thinks Junior rushed through the planning.
He thought he knew the river better than anyone and put together a barrel of 13 inner tubes lashed with fishnet. And he was warned by his friends and other rivermen that he, at 150 pounds, weighed more than the barrel, and that he would be thrown out of the barrel if it got into trouble in the upper rapids.
Red Jr.'s one and only attempt came on August 4th, 1951.
There was a tremendous crowd at the brink of the falls. There had been a lot of publicity over this. Newspapers estimated the crowd anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000 people. So it was a really big event. He got into the river probably a mile above the falls at Chippewa and slowly went down the river with all these people watching, cheering, and then finally aghast at the barrel coming apart. And I think he was probably dead before he went over the falls.
The grieving Hill family mostly stayed away from the river after that. Their mother and Red Hill Sr.'s widow, Beatrice, passed away in 1974 after a life of heartbreak. She simply couldn't understand why she had been unable to keep her men away from the river and why it held such a lure for them. After talking with many other people fascinated by the river, Clarkson has a theory.
I think the Niagara seems to draw people, seems to pull them. William Fitzgerald, who went over in 1961 in a rubber ball, he told me that when he was 5 years old, he went to Niagara Falls with his parents, and that roar of Niagara Falls stayed with him, haunting him for years. That damn water wouldn't shut up. The raw power, he said, that unleashed power.
The hills never shut out that roar, and their story didn't end in 1951 with Red Jr.'s death, because the hills inspired daredevils who still admire them and remember their stories.
As a teenager in the 1950s, Dave Munday, the stories of the hills really enraptured him. He knew the hills never got over the falls and lived. And in 1985, yes, he did it. And he survived. The Red Hill family, I think they made it over the falls in a way because they inspired Dave Mundy.
Peter DiBernardi, who went over the falls in 1989, started a campaign in 2016 to raise money for a memorial at Niagara Falls.
To date, there is no memorial for the Red Hill family. Red Hill and his sons did not get the credit they deserved for everything they did on the river. The rescues, the daredevil acts, bringing attention to Niagara Falls. And yes, there needs to be some sort of memorial for the Red Hill family.
That's Michael Clarkson speaking with Only a Game's Gary Wallach. You can learn more about the Red Hill family in Clarkson's book, The Age of Daredevils. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from the Niagara Falls. It always seems to have the final word, doesn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.